Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to This Is Africa, a podcast where four individuals within the African diaspora are here to talk about social and political issues that our continent is facing. Today, we'll be talking about education in Africa, how we are faring in comparison to the rest of the world. But to start off, let's just talk about the importance of education. Well, actually, to start off, like I said, gentlemen, ladies and gents listening here today, this is Africa. My name is Adama.
My name is Amiri.
Hi, everyone. My name is Lord.
Hi, guys. My name is Tamba.
All right. Then make sure we get our names in there. But again, like I said, today we're just going to start off speaking about education and stuff like that. But to start, I definitely did want to get everybody's opinion on just the importance of education all around the world. You know, one of my favorite quotes comes from Nelson Mandela. And he said that education is the most powerful weapon which we can use to change the world. I don't think it could be said any better. Education is the key to everything and anything. All the greats have reiterated over and over and over again in the blueprint. It's education. Like the longest and the hardest part, but the most important part to achieving success is the work. It's the grind. It's sitting down, absorbing information from people who've done it before you, from ideas you may see every day that you wake up. But the biggest thing in the world is to absorb, keep your brain open, educate yourself. And that's the only way we can continue to build the future and continue to build empires and to keep like moving our world forward. But what about you guys?
Yeah, like you said, you know, the human mind makes it possible for, you know, all other like achievements, you know, as far as like, you know, health advances, agricultural innovations, infrastructure constructions, the private sector, development in general, and even the reduction of poverty. So, you know, this is really the key, in my opinion, of ultimately growing the continent in general. And also we've seen, you know, multiple nations, you know, focus on their education, which brought them to this fruitful new way in their country. The country I'm thinking in particular right now is Singapore. You know, we saw the growth that did along with other things, but one of their primary focuses was education, and we can see where they're at today.
I believe that education is definitely very essential, not only to human growth and human development, but I also feel like education, it's again, Adama, as you said, the key to everything, because an educated population or an educated society definitely elevates us on a higher level in every aspect of our lives. So I'm a strong believer in education. I'm a strong believer that everybody should have access to education. I'm a strong believer in that regardless of your gender, you should have access to education. I believe that education is a human right. I believe that education insulates us from ignorant, education helps us from educating each other on just basically just our lives, our background. Education does not necessarily have to be just book education. Just learning about each other is also education too, as well. It prevents us from ignorant, like, how do I formulate this? Yeah, ignorant ideas that fester, you know, just because people didn't know better or just don't know because they didn't have the education, then people suffer. You know what I'm saying? So I'm a very strong believer in education.
I would say education is important because you could say that it kind of like breaks certain cycles, especially like family cycles, whereas like say like your parents or grandparents wasn't as educated. I believe that say if you become educated, you'll be more enlightened and more you'll be able to offer more resources to them in terms of like open up a new perspective, a new point of view. And you know, education is also a way of like bringing you out of certain situations too, you know, whether it's poverty and other circumstances, you know. So I feel like education is very important for the society as a whole, just to have access to knowledge, you know. It's very important to individuals, you know.
Yeah, and to piggyback what Emery said a little bit. I actually have like a little cool story that my father, you know, told me all the time when, you know, I didn't do well in school, or, you know, I always thought that school was not important. So he told me that my great grandfather, you know, he was a peasant. He worked in the fields, in the farms, and, you know, that was basically going to be the destiny of my whole lineage in a small country. I mean, not a small country, but in Mali, you know, a small community in Mali. We probably would have never got out of there. We would have stayed there forever. And then today, I would have been there today. But he did one thing, you know, he understood the value of education, and he sent my grandfather to school. You know, that's one person that he sent to school. My grandfather went to school, and, you know, he excelled, obviously. He got to where he's at, and he created opportunity not only for him, but for generations that followed after him. You know, he had a son. His son prevailed in education as well. And now I'm here today, sitting here in, you know, a different country, experienced the most, visited like a bunch of countries, lived there, experienced their education system. And that's just one example of how it can change one's community, you know?
I guess like it's definitely key that you say, like, initially, like, it was almost as if your lineage was destined for agriculture. Yeah. Like, it was that's almost what it was. But it took a very risky and, like, because there's nothing that says, like, yeah, generations will be able to have access to the same opportunity as what I have now, even, or whatever it may be. But he took the risk. And I guess, like, you see education differently in plenty of places in the world. For some people, it's desperation. Like, for him, it was, I don't want to see a lineage of agriculture. You know what I mean? Like, I want to open these avenues up for my family, for family members that I don't even know are born yet. And I guess, like, yeah, definitely education, just like it's different all across the board and stuff like that. But on this table alone, we've all had different educational experiences. Half of us went to school in different parts of the world. Some of us went to school exactly like in the countries that, you know, obviously we're born from. And then we kind of, we've been able to basically see different points of views. We've been able to see how cultures impact education, how education impacts culture in different communities across the world. But what are some like educational culture differences that we may have seen or that we kind of experience? Like for me, I can say I went to school here in America. So I would say I probably had a different experience from you guys on the other side of this table here, but I was made very aware at a young age that there were big differences in how we learn over here and how people learn back home. What's important to focus on, for one, was one of the biggest things. My dad used to tell me, like, I used to come in and maybe around fifth grade, I think I was learning division, and I was struggling. Like, it was bad. Like, I was having a hard time, like, just putting these numbers together and, like, figuring out this math thing and dividing. But my dad, he just didn't have the patience. I guess I would say maybe because of the way he learned back home or whatever it was. But for him, it was like, how do you not know this? It's like, well, like, you know what I mean? I'm like, look, it's in the book. The book says this. You know what I mean? Like this is what the book is saying.
Just to cover your point, African parents are not the best people to teach you anything. Let's just put it out there, okay? They're really not the best.
I definitely cried that
day. I came
back
with a test one time. It was a math test. It was algebra, and I brought it to my mom, you know, because in the United States, if you do a test, you got to send it to your parents for them to sign.
That's facts. They're signing homeworks.
I ain't get a good score in it. Mm. So my mom saw it. She goes, so simple 1, 2, 3 cannot add. And I'm just like, there is X, Y, B, Z.
Yep. I can't all add letters, stuff mom. In it. I can't add letters.
Because here's the thing. Like, once I was doing homework, and then my mom goes, you want me to help you because I was struggling there. And this was it was algebra. So I gave it to her, and she was even struggling herself. So I'm just like, wait, what's going on? He's a simple 1, 2, 3. I can't do anything, but there's X, Y, and Z into it too. So I understand you. It's just, they're not very patient.
Yeah, facts.
When they teach you stuff. Yeah, African parents are not able to teach you anything. No, not teach you anything, but when it comes to schoolwork, they're not patient.
Yeah, facts. Like, even like, the patience is definitely one major point that African parents are almost, people of minority or like people of color, like in general, I feel like you hear that across a lot of cultures, just the patience level. But then like one of the key things that struck me was that my dad like kind of made a point out of the fact that he learned this already. Like in like second or third grade, he was in multiplications and math and like dividing. And like he was doing the stuff that I was doing at fourth grade or something like that already. So even though the answers or the way that like the method to get to the solution were different, for some reason, like I guess in Africa, it was more important for people to learn like some of the more, I guess, later subjects in America earlier over there. And I don't know if that's a case of because the demand for certain fields is more necessary, or is it like I don't know, is that a structure thing? Like you guys can speak more to it, but yeah.
So it kind of, I think, I have to do like a childhood development type of structure thing, whereas depending on the country that you grew up in, you know. So like from my experiences, like I was born here and I followed the American system of education, you know, whereas like my parents and like my mom's my father, they've more followed like a, they're from Trinidad, so they've more followed like a British system of education, you know. So what you could, I could compare the differences and say that like my parents also always used to say that like when they come up here, like the material of work was a little bit easier because they break down things to a simpler, to a simpler standard, you know, whereas in the British system they more just, they would just say A, B, C, whereas the American system, they'll say like A to the second power, B to the second power, and C to the second power. You know, so they kind of like explain more of the material, the work in the American system, whereas the British system is like, and then in the British system too, like you have to cover a lot of things in a short period of time, you know? Whereas the American system, it might take like 2 semesters to just cover like one topic, you know? And they'll break it down into like part one, part two. So like, I could say that's a lot of, in the Caribbean too, a lot of like students that come up here to learn, kind of not more advanced, but they learn the material quicker than the students that was up here already, you know. Hence the reason why like a lot of people that came from overseas, whether Africa or the Caribbean, they do say like the work is a little bit slightly easier, you know. And then too is like the only thing that I would say here is that they provide a lot of resources, you know, to help the student move forward, you know. Whereas in the Caribbean is like a little bit more, you know, you gotta be very self-disciplined, you know. And then too, dealing with like the culture of our parents and stuff too, is like, you know, they own you if you don't, if you're not making good grades, you know. So yeah, I feel like just, and then to take a historical point of view too, yeah, it's based like on like which country colonized your country. That's the system of education you're gonna follow, you know. So I know you guys probably have like different countries that colonize your home country, so they follow a different system, you know.
I will say as well, like just to be thinking about it, well, I guess obviously you guys were more deep into it, but my entire life, all I've known is an American school system. You know, I've never been able to experience like another, like I went to private school, like an Islamic school and stuff like that. So I got to experience different cultures a little bit, but it was still in the same country. So, you know, rules have to be followed. But I would love to hear what it's like to literally go from an entirely different culture and like the way discipline is considered, the like the principles that are held to a certain degree, and like coming here and hearing that shift, like, you know.
All right, children, gather around, story time. First of all, school survival of the fittest back in, okay, everything I'm going to talk about right now is back in Ghana. And I'm sure some people listening to this will definitely resonate with some things that I'm talking about. School is survival of the fittest back in Ghana. I went to elementary school in Ghana, so I went from preschool to class 6. So in Ghana's classes, I like the state to say grade 1, grade 2, grade 3. Yeah. Over there is class 1, class 2, class 3, so on and so forth. School is tough. It's very structured. It's very disciplined. And the culture of school back in Ghana was strict. So, for example, in terms of learning things, so you see how you, Adama, you said when they came to when your parents came to the United States, things were a lot easier. Because back at home, when they're teaching you, they expect you to know a whole bunch of stuff right then and there, and not even know it, but know it by heart, and not even know it by heart, but be able to know. So, for example, when I came to the States in middle school, they were learning about the human body in the 8th grade. I learned about the human body in the 5th grade. So I had to learn what the digestive system was, what the circulatory system was. I had to learn all 206 bones in the human body. I had to learn a lot.
Let me just ask. All
right.
What is that like? Like literally, like, I remember being in eighth grade and finally had my first health class, and it was still queasy. Like, we're talking about kids, like, who are immature. You know what I mean?
All right. Learn about the human body and health is two different subjects. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Human body is more.
Yeah. In the health class, we went through the body.
Not in the. All right. So the way you're looking at it from the United States perspective, we learn about the human body more scientifically in terms of, like, how does the digestive system work? How does the circulatory system work? How does the nervous system work? Like, we learn it on a science level, but we learn at a younger age compared to people who are over here.
Yeah.
So my friends are looking at me like, how do you even know this? And I'm just telling them, I already know this from back home. Y'all just got accustomed to this or just learned this information, but I've already known about this information a long time ago. School was very, very structured. It was very disciplined. The way we were taught. So, for example, another story that I have. My experience with math, I have a love-hate relationship with math. Here's why.
Yeah, me too.
Because in school back in Ghana, we have something called mental. So mental is like it's a quiz, but you have to say it very fast. So, for example, if I ask Amiri, what's 4 times 4? And if you don't say the next 5 seconds, all right, spoiler, not even spoiler alert, just for y'all to know, you get whooped in school in Ghana. Like, that's just the educational culture norm. You just get whooped in school. So, for example, if I ask Amiri 4 times 4 and Amiri goes, you're getting your butt whooped, you have to say within the next 5 seconds. If not, then you're in trouble. So that's how it was. School was very, very competitive. Like, according to my family, if you didn't make top 10, and top 10 is too much wiggle room for you to be in, you got to make at least top 5.
Yeah.
If I didn't make top 5, then my parents looked at me like, what are you doing with your life?
Yeah. Oh,
That's how school was for us. So we had something called dictation. It was a spelling quiz. And in Ghana, the amount of wrongs that you get on your spelling quiz determine how much you're gonna get whooped. So school was tough. School was very tough. So you really had to be on your A game. It wasn't so much as leisure as it is in the United States compared to back home. Back home, school was very, very structured. And not only just in terms of just knowledge wise, but just how you carry yourself in school too was a big deal. Yeah. So I went to private school in Ghana. So you cannot even come into school looking raggedy. Your socks had to be white. Your school clothes had to be iron and pressed. Your hair got to be a certain way. Your nails got to be clipped a certain way.
Yeah.
We had something called assembly. We have that every morning. And then what they'll do that, we call it inspection. So teachers will come around. If your socks are dirty, you're getting whooped on the legs. That hurts so much. if your nails were not the certain length, you get a ruler and they hit you on your nails. It was very, very structured and very, very tough. It was rigorous. I'm not even going to lie to you. So when I came to the States, boy, life was good.
For me, I had... similar experiences with Lord in Mali. Yes, and some of the stuff you said about hitting, yeah, that does happen in school. But me particularly, I had the luck of both going to public school in Mali and private school. And I want to highlight some of the differences between the two already. I'm going to start with the public school. So I went to public school in Mali from like kindergarten here to like, I would say, third grade, and we were about, in the third grade class, we had like 60 students in the class, if I'm remembering correctly. I know the teachers, we had one teacher per those 60 students, so it was very hard for the teachers to get a hold of us, but school was kind of an extension, our teachers were kind of the extension of our parents, so we respected them very well, because if you don't respect them, you know what would happen. So they didn't have trouble, keeping us in line, but in terms of like teaching us the material, I don't know how much they were trying to get out of us, you know, second, third grade, but it was hard for them to get the material. And us going back home, it was, when you get taught at those ages, is more, you know, learning words, you know, stuff like that. So it's kind of harder with everybody in the class. You have to raise your hand and stuff like that, get the student, the teacher's attention. And when I moved to private school, a big difference that I saw was that the classes size first were smaller, you know, way smaller. The teacher was able to key in on a student. There were still some of those, you know, this, I guess, the teacher still being strict and stern, but they had time for each individual student, and they could kind of, you know, if you needed something, they could help you with those things. Some of the major differences I saw in the American system, because I also went to school in France, so I kind of know that a little bit. Being here, I went from ninth grade to, I guess, all the way throughout college, I've been in the American system. And some of the biggest differences I would say when I was, you know, in eighth, seventh grade, because that was kind of in the same area, is that in Africa, I guess in Mali, they teach you, it's more to like, you have to remember a lot. So it's a lot of memorizing the information. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's all memorizing. And here it's more like they're teaching you to understand the material. Yeah. So you know why you're using it. They want you to understand the concept rather than just memorizing.
Yeah, true.
So for example, when Lord was saying the dictations, those things, when I would just go home and just memorize as much as I can, right? Memorize all the words. And when I got to class, it was basically, yeah, I'm just going to write it down and do the best. So it's all memorization. If I forgot something, it's probably because I didn't spend enough time memorizing the night before. The only thing you didn't have to memorize in was math, because math, you kind of, that's like that problem solving stuff. But in history, the questions would be like, like, you know, for example, in your classes here, it would be like, what, you had DBQs and stuff like that. And in the DBQs, you had to, you know, make an essay out of like a period in history.
Yeah, yeah.
In Mali, from what I remember, in one of my history classes, it was just what happened in, I guess, like the... And we also learned like a lot of like European stuff, like, oh, what happened in like something in World War II? And then we would take a paragraph that the teacher wrote on the board. You just have to recite that to the T, and that's what you're graded on. You're not graded on how much you understand the concept of what happened during World War II. You're more graded on how much can you remember from the text. And that those were like some of the major differences that I saw in the system. Also, some between the public and private school, I always said the people and the number of people in the classes. In the private school, your parents, like Laura was saying in America, your parents are very, very, very involved in terms of that the teachers, you know, we had parent-teacher meetings all like every trimester at my private school. You know, it was a really good private school. And there, you know, the teacher and the parents are basically, they know everything about each other. Like they would even go to your house for parent-teacher meetings if they needed to make sure the student was on board and to let them know what was going on in the classroom. In public school, there's no chance that you're seeing that. Mm. No chance that you're seeing that. Some of the kids that go to school, they probably go to school and skip it. At least in my life, they would go to school, they go to class, and the teachers will not show up. The teacher will not be there. So they basically have, you know, recess the whole time, playing in school. You know, some people would come to school because some school would give out meals. So you come to school to get the meal to eat because you can't get food at home, and then you're going right back. So those are some of the things culturally that were there.
I had a question for TK. So you say that, like back home in Mali and stuff, they wasn't very rigorous about like critical thinking skills, right? Because I know like when I was in middle school and you can say like elementary school and high school, like they was very keen about being able to critically think. So they'll try to apply, even like that's why I appreciate a lot of like my teachers and stuff, you know, because a lot of my teachers were like black teachers from like the same environment, same background as me, you know. So like they would try to apply like what we're learning in school and how does it apply to like real life, you know, or try to make a connection to like what we learned in school and connect it to things that we are interested in, you know? So, like, it's a way of, like, trying to keep the students engaged, you know, mm-hmm. into the material, because, like, we all know that schoolwork gets boring, and, like, you have to be very, very, very self-disciplined to, like, keep on top of your stuff, you know? Like,
yeah, I mean, I guess in my family, I was very lucky, because in the position I was in, but my parents, you know, they hold education at a really high standard. Like I told you the story about my grandfather, you know, as you see, my dad is his son, and he held that to the same standard because he knew the value of education because he went to school, you know. So for me, coming from school and coming home, my parents were on top of me. Hey, do your homework. Do you do this? You cannot go outside. So I would say I was one of the lucky ones, but there's some students that probably would go home and their parents, you know, don't have time for that. You know, in a public school, I know for a fact they're in Mali, at least their parents did not have time for that. Their parents were not educated where they could help them with their homework. You know, it all comes down to what your teacher teaches and how much you can retain and go home and practice it yourself. Of course, there's been, you know, a lot of, you know, success stories, but I feel like that's one of the disparities. If you want to talk about disparities, that happens. The public school system in Mali, it's not good, and in a lot of African countries, they're struggling with the same problem.
Well, I guess since you touched on it, disparities keyword. We already addressed a lot of the issues between public and private schools. Like you addressed public and private school differences, in Mali specifically that you've experienced in your life. But I guess like, what are some of the disparities that we see? Like, even Lord as well, you've gone to private school and thingy in your country. So just in general, I guess more now, like what are some disparities we see across the world between here and Africa, or even more in depth within Africa as we know it?
All right. So, one disparity that I could probably say is that, so for example, back in Ghana, so where we had tests and we were about to take a test, if you didn't bring a pen or pencil, God bless you, because you're not taking that test. Because your teacher is going to school you on, so if a farmer is going to the farm, he's not going to forget his tools. So why are you forgetting your pen and pencil? One of the biggest culture shocks that I had was definitely in school, but one of the biggest culture shocks that I had in school was that students will forget their pens and pencils, and the teachers will give it to you. And I'm just looking like, oh, okay, so I'm here. I'm in the States. Like, they just give you pencils and pens just like that. It's a good and bad thing, depending on how you look at it, because in Ghana, it definitely taught you self-responsibility in terms of, hey, if you're coming to take a test, like, you better be prepared. But it's also a bad thing because a student does not have the opportunity to take a test because maybe what if the student did not have access to get a pen or pencil? In the States, too, the same way is in terms of they give you the pen and pencil, but you also... I wouldn't say robbing the student, but you're also not helping the student have self-responsibility to bring a pen and pencil when it's time to take a test. So that's one difference, big difference that I saw going to school in Ghana and going to school over here.
Yeah, in terms of disparities, I agree with Lord. I guess the word is lack of resources. You know, depending on whether you're going to school here or there, the difference is the schools, at least public school, they don't have the resources. You know, if you're going to private school in Mali, at least, your parents could afford to buy you, you know, pens, pencils, notebooks, books. And it's your responsibility, along with them following you, to keep those intact, right? Then if you mess any of your school supplies up, you have to deal with your parents, right? In public schools, you know, some of these people don't have... the resources to even buy those things. So the government, in the first place, I don't think are providing, you know, those resources like the books. As you can see in Africa, when a lot of celebrities go, you see they go to schools and they buy them pens, pencil, books and stuff like that. So they could be able to use, so they could get that. I remember a big thing when I was in a first grade in a public school system in Mali, a big thing, we had a little chalkboard, right, in our hand, and we had chalk. They gave us chalk. And we would do our equations on that, and you just erase it with your hand. We didn't even have, you know, notebooks and stuff like that. While here in first grade, you're already getting ready to write with a pen and pencil. Man, you know what I mean? So it's like a big difference in, you know, those are some of the disparities. So lack of resources. You know, I guess teachers caring, you know, in a public school system, teachers, you know, as much as I don't want to discredit them, I feel like they probably don't care as much because maybe they're paid. Now that I'm older, I can see that they're maybe not getting paid enough to deal with 70 students. You know, they probably not. In a private school, the classes were smaller. They were getting paid fairly well, you know, compared to public school teachers, and they cared a little more. But even them, to a certain point, they didn't care as much.
Well, I appreciate the alley-oop, Rondo. Just touching on, like, incentive for teachers and stuff like that, I think that was kind of one of the, like, even going back to our initial point, first thing I asked you guys was, why is education so important, right? True teachers, real teachers, understand how important it is, how important education is, and how important it is to invest in another human being's life. How important it is to sit down and be, like, teachers, although we call them teachers, they're parents. Like, they are just as much of a parent as your mother and your father. And in the state specifically, as far as I know, I'm with my teacher 8 hours a day, 5 days a week for majority of the year. My parents see me for 4 or 5 hours at the end of the day. 2 of those hours includes my mom making food for me, and I'm going to sleep. Like, I'm not even communicating with my mom and dad that much up until I get to an age where I have more freedom, like now. So basically, the parents that have come through my life have been teachers. And if I did not have the right teachers to invest in me, to look at me and be like, all right, I think you're worth something, and to sit down and take the patience to teach me in a way that's meant for Adama and not meant for Brian or Brandon, like, because I am my own entity, you know what I mean? There is a way that I learn best. And for teachers to go out of their way to micromanage that and to go out, it takes a lot. But that right there, like, to get a person to do that, first, a lot of things need to be in place. I have to have all the tools around me to be able to give another human being everything that I can to put them in the best possible position. And in a lot of places in Africa, there aren't those tools. A lot of teachers don't have the incentives to sit down and work, you know what I mean? To sit down and give students their all, to sit down and be like, oh yeah, this is this or this is that. In a lot of places, I'll list out some of them, but the median average earning of a teacher in across Africa is about $680 per month. This is public. $680 per month. I'm a young student. I just graduated recently, and I pull in about $4,000 a month, and I'm just doing delivery driving right now. I'm sorry, $4,000 a week. I'm sorry, $3,000. No, sorry, wait, I said a week. I dragged it. A month. Okay. $1,000 a week, basically, can be pulled in through dropping off food. You're telling me the person who's responsible for the future of the world is making less money than me, and I'm dropping off people's food? That's insane to me. And even going over more specific, I'll list out some more countries for the listener out there, because we went over some of them. But like in Congo, they're making $100 per month on average. In Liberia, $400 a month on average. I'm sorry, Liberia, $220 a month on average. Niger, $400 a month on average. Ghana, $640 on average. Tanzania, $800 on average. Zambia, $1,600 a month on average. Like, there is no incentive for these teachers to come in and teach students, to keep them engaged. Like, there is nothing for that, and that's something that definitely needs to be addressed.
Yeah, I do agree with you that teacher may be getting underpaid, right? But also, you have to remember, $1,600 over there a month could be a lot.
It's not.
You know, but I'm saying, for example, 1,600, like, it could be a lot for them, because obviously the way, yeah, the exchange rate is different, and the way they living wage is different as well. So there may be differences, but I do agree with you with your point, the principle of it. Teachers are not getting paid enough to care about the student even. But yeah, isn't that just to play the devil's advocate a little bit? Isn't that if a teacher decides to take in that career path, because they know before they get there the pay is not the best, of course, right? So isn't that the sacrifice that maybe they're taking to, they want to change that system, they want to help the student? Isn't it, shouldn't it be oriented towards the student more? Maybe just that's just a question I'm just asking. I don't know the answer, but what do you think?
Like, all right, rephrase your question for me one more time. Like you're saying, is it more important for the teacher to like come in and make that sacrifice?
No, I'm saying, but they know what the wages of a teacher are. You're saying they know what they're getting into. Yeah, they know what they're getting into, and they're willing to make that sacrifice.
Okay.
You know, for example, I had an example of teachers not showing up. Because do they really care about the students if they're not showing up? You know, obviously, it's a lot more complicated. Yeah, but, you know, there's different things that play a factor into that.
I mean, yeah, I understand that it's supposed to be student-oriented, but at the end of the day, teachers are also human beings. At the end of the day, they got their own kids to feed. They got their family to take. They got the family to take care of. They got other responsibilities that they need to take care of. Yes, at the end of the day, you're doing it for the students, and you're passionate about your job.
Yeah.
But also, at the end of the
day, it's easier to be passionate with your wallet looking okay.
you need to make a living for yourself, no matter how much passion you put behind your work. If it feel like if it's not paying off, at least monetarily, it kind of discourages you a little bit. At the end of the day, you're a human being. You're supposed to, you know, get paid for the level of productivity that you bring.
Yes. You know, and teachers should be living in mansions.
At the end of the day,
I firmly believe that
I get the point of it's supposed to be student oriented. Okay. But also at the end of the day, too, we have to understand that teachers are human beings, and they need to make a living for themselves.
Yeah, and I do agree with that. That's a great point. I was just playing devil's advocate. I saw the other side, but I just wanted somebody to say it. There are a lot of things going on right now in Africa that are trying to change that. The Bridge, Bridge International, which is headquartered in Kenya, which they're creating low-cost private schools, right? All over Africa, they're trying to place their cells in different countries. And they are backed by basically the rich people in America, or just rich people in general, who will fund donations. And they're creating environments where kids could go to school. They're a little private school, low-cost. All the parents have to pay for are the uniforms, and they provide the pens, pencils, and they have the class size and everything else. And, you know, it's working out pretty well for them. Like, the whole system is designed that later they're going to make money when these students, you know, develop. But right now, this could be a good thing that maybe some African countries could look at to adopt. I already know that Liberia adopted this. There's also, a bit of a fight between public and private schools, because public school teachers feel like, oh, these low-cost schools are coming and taking all the opportunity for them, and they're not respecting all the laws in said country, whatever country they're in. But, you know, I think that it could be a good thing ultimately, because it is helping the students. And if we really, like we said at the beginning, the importance of education can change a community and even a whole nation, right? So if we focus on stuff like that, getting the kids in school, it's going to pay in the back end. And I actually want to take this time to segue into a little simulation with all of you. I have a little prompt here. So the prompts are the student / parent, the government, and the teachers. The name of the country is country A. Okay, we're not going to name the country because we don't want to get into that. Adama, you know, since you were advocating for teachers so much, you will be the teacher.
Yes, sir.
Amiri, you will be the student / parent. And Lord, you'll be the government. Is that okay with everybody?
That's fine by me, sir.
All right. So the student, your prompt is you just want a better education, more opportunities, and you want school to restart. Because your school, you're on strike right now. The teachers, you went on strike because you're not getting paid enough and you're not willing to compromise. The government, your role is you're the ultimate power. You have the ultimate decision of if the teachers are getting paid and if school's getting restarted, but you do not have the funds at the moment to increase the teachers' pay. And that is your prompt, and go.
To start, I'm well aware that in a government, teacher A speaking here. Yeah. to start, I am well aware that our government has several areas that it needs to focus on in order to keep our country stable and to help move us forward in the future. And funding may be a struggle right now, but it would be nice for our government to care as much about education as the teachers and the students of the country do, and maybe find ways to divert funding from other sources or areas and send them back this way. Because with the way things are feeling or the way that they may be going, I don't see a positive end to this journey if there isn't more funding or more things that help us do our job better.
So you want me to raise... I'm government aid. So my question is, so you want me to raise students, teachers' pay?
I didn't give anything specific, but even if it's not pay, whether it might be... Pay would be great.
Okay.
I don't know. But even if it's not pay, whether it's tools and better classroom structures, new seats, a playground, I don't know. Cool tools and accessories that we can work with in the schools that we're not still using old material or anything like that. Or even incentives, benefits that may come after, whether it's health insurance or sick days, holidays, stuff like that. Those are all things that we feel like we're lacking.
I get your point in terms of putting more or allocating more funds into the education system. But however, as you said, we are constrained to a lot of other issues and other things that we need to put our money into. So, for example, we need to put a lot of money into our health system. We need to put a lot of money into our infrastructure system. We need to put our a lot of money into our defense. We need to put a lot of money into providing basic needs for our people. Because at the end of the day, if I'm funding education and I'm not providing basic needs, just for example, such as food, if a student is going to school hungry and I'm not putting enough money into, let's say, food programs or food allocation programs, no matter how much money I put into education or telling kids to enroll in education or providing more educational resources, if they're not being used efficiently or effectively because of other constraints that people deal with in their daily lives, how can that yield effective results in the future where there are some things that are lacking that are holding people back?
I'm going to take a second to give it to the students and parents, see if they have anything to say about this.
Well, at the end of the day, all of us have some type of responsibility to uphold, you know? So, us as a parent and student, we uphold our bargain as me sending my child to school to educate themselves. So I expect that the teacher and the government are doing their part too, because what else are they going to do besides not go to school? Or I could just put them in the workforce and let them just work one of my farms, you know, and hopefully make some type of money there, then, but there's no guaranteed future by doing that. You know, so it's like I am upholding myself and my child to go to school. So I expect that the teacher and the government are upholding their standards too. You know?
It couldn't be said any better. If there is no, like, that's the ultimatum that people are facing now. And it's like kind of, to the point where a story I once heard from a friend of mine, he told me that his grandfather had to decide between spending a life in agriculture or risking everything on education. The opportunity was not placed in front of him by his government. It was not given to him by the people who could have. It was taken by himself. He had to grab it, reach out, and say, I can't risk a life of agriculture. Like, I can't make the next president farming. He has to go to school. So... even addressing like the eating points, like most students eat at school. Most of the students come here to get that meal, to take that home. And then as far as funding allocation, and like, I did bring up the point that, yeah, there are definitely a plethora of things that we do have to focus on. The way funding allocation has gone, we've yet to focus on education and we've yet to see any positive benefits from it. So I think it's time to take a new look. So what can you do? I guess is the real question.
Yeah. So as a parent too, I also have to spend some type of expenses on my child, whether it's uniform or paying some type of school expenses or some type of cost to, for my child to go to school. So where's that money going if it's not going to the teachers or it's being reinvested into my child? Like, this country gets a lot of money from whether it's foreign countries or whether it's from, like, getting money from, like, our exports and imports. So, like, where is that? Why is a certain amount of money being allocated towards focusing on our younger generations? You know, like, why is that even a problem? Why is teachers being paid less, and why is, like, my child not want to go to school because they don't see no benefit in it? Be even a problem, like, you know.
I mean, I get it, and I understand in terms of increasing more funds for education, or allocating more funds for education, or giving teachers better pay. But however, just because I'm funding education, or, you know, telling students and kids to go to school, or giving teachers better pay, there are other things that are, there's a difference between, okay, funding and giving teachers more pay, or funding in, okay, or just funding education, giving more funding to education for students to go to school. But then what is the incentive to keep them there? Because at the end of the day, if, let's say, for example, hear my point. For example, if I'm funding education, right, and students are going to school, but then, for example, mom is not getting food, or basic needs are not being taken care of, what is my reason to keep going to school?
Well, that's your fault too.
That's what I'm saying. I have to allocate money into basic needs first, because no student can learn.
You've been allocating, and my mom is still hungry. You've been allocating. My mom is still hungry. You've been allocating, and we still don't have school. You've been allocating. We don't have safety.
It's not about being allocating and you don't have safety, or in terms of still hungry. That we have to make sure that at the end of the day, it's not about enrolling students to school, but it's more so retaining students in school. And the way to retain students is for them not to have adult-like situation or real situations that hold them back from going to school, in terms of, what if they're the only ones that can take care of their family? Because, for example,
because of your lack of access to opportunity.
That's why I'm funding education. I'm not funding education, but I'm putting resources into those things to take care of those first.
But you've already failed the old people.
Who's talking about failing over here?
Because you're talking about responsibilities that a student may have for somebody at home, but you've already failed to give them that access to opportunity. So the goal is now, the new opportunity is to give.
That I'm constrained on funding. Like, you get
I
it.
Didn't say you were constrained. You said you were constrained. I told
no,
you to.
No, you said you get it. You said that I get it, that you have to fund other things, right?
I get because that money is needed to go to different areas.
Because you understand the importance of them, right?
But education is the most important one, if you get to do that. It's the whole point. But nobody
can learn on an empty stomach. Nobody can learn if safety is a problem. Nobody can learn if a student goes to school and is on his way coming back home and feel that their life is in danger because there's no proper either police patrol or they're not getting fed at home, or they're the oldest at home, or just things that are prevented them from actually getting a quality education.
As the mediator, I will give the voice to the parent. This is, we're kind of short on time, so wrap up your points, please.
So government, or politician, if you want to say.
Why are you calling me a politician?
He's a politician, you know? Government.
That's the only way you can attack him wholeheartedly.
All right, government. So why should the president own 5 Range Rovers?
That's going into a totally different topic.
From what I've seen on the news, the president owned 5 Range Rovers and 2 Lamborghinis in a climate, in a place that we don't even have roads. You feel me? So why should my child be struggling to get food and go to school, and then I have to come out of my hard-earned money pocket to pay for that.
Put more money into food and taking care of basic needs first before looking into education. I know you feel some type of... I know it doesn't sound palatable, but at the end of the day, I have to make sure that basic needs are taken care of first, and I'm giving more funding and allocation to that than before I go into education.
Voice to the teacher.
So you fail to do your job, and you want to keep.
Where is
you
the failing keep, coming
hold
on, wait, from?
Hold on, time. Look, just hear me out. Hear me out. You fail to already do the proper, like, giving people the the clean things you claim are so necessary. We've fairly known for a long period of time. There are necessary things. Cool. But you've been allocating to those things. The majority of the money has been going in that direction, and you failed. So you want to continue to fund and divert money to that. You feel like that's the solution. But what I'm here to tell you is that it's not. It's time to reevaluate the plan. The plan is now to invest into the future. You've already, like, put people in a position to struggle is my point. So it's like continuously giving money and, like, trying to divert the majority of funding towards, like, making sure that, oh, like, trying to redo the things that you've already said you were trying to do in the first place, which is giving us necessary things and making sure there's benefits and, like, people can have, you know, I don't even know what benefits you're giving me if you're not giving me direct money, but, like, you're giving us tools and stuff to go to the supermarket and buy food through what cards, like EBTs and stuff like that they may have in the States or whatever it might be. That's not what's necessary. Because if you continue to do that, then there will continue to be no money for schools and the retention rate will continue to go down. It's going down already because of what you're doing. So I'm telling you, it's time to reevaluate the plan and reinvest in the students so they can take that big leap. Instead of staying in agriculture and taking those benefits, allow them to take that risk in education so that maybe they can come back and not have to do that originally, is my thing with you. Because you're not, you're telling me that you're investing and, like, you have to keep giving to this, to this, to this, but why? Why does it have to go to that and not my education?
We're going to finish it. This is going to be the last point from the government, and then we're going to see if
deal can be struck. Last point, remember, you are responsible for everybody's thing. So even though you, like, the people in front of you are complaining and you're telling me you have to do something for somebody else, so please tell me what you can do for me.
All right, this is the last point coming from the government.
That's what I'd like to hear.
I mean, first of all, funding other aspects of the country does not only benefit somebody else, it also benefits you too, whether directly or indirectly.
That's a lie.
Where's the lie coming from?
All right, here's why am I on strike?
Am
I not on strike right now?
Here's the thing. How could you expect a student to learn if they're hungry? How could you expect a student to learn if their parents are sick and there's no and I'm not putting more into hospitals and stuff. How do you expect students to learn if there's no infrastructure for them to have transportation to go to school? How can you expect all
if
of that to happen?
In school, there's no school. I'm striking. I am striking right now. There is no school. All right.
Now, that's what I'm telling you. If you do not invest in me,
I cannot teach. There is no incentive for me to teach.
Yeah, I guess it's very simple, bro.
You're telling me you're gonna do stuff for the outside of things, but I cannot teach. Like, I can't do my job.
I mean, as you guys can see, the people listening to us, things get very heated. In these discussions. We see that, you know, between government and teachers and government and other entities, it really gets really, really heated. And it's much more complex than we're making it seem. But this was just a taste of what we think a conversation would go between the government and the teachers. Of course, there will be a little more information between the two entities. But unfortunately, as much as I like this, we have to wrap it up. We're running a little over on time. For any questions, you know, on this topic, you can always reach us at thisisafricapodcast24@gmail.com. Watch out for us on Instagram, This Is Africa Podcast, on iTunes and Spotify. We are gonna upload these things up there soon. This was a great conversation. The simulation was great, and I hope you guys enjoyed.
Pick them one by one. Peace. Make me bust my gun. Poison us like a long python. Gunfire.